thank you. A bit of a question and a bit of a disagreement, I think. I agree that there are ideologies that don't take us forward in a generative sense, that are not good for the world. But in my language, I would see Buddhism as an ideology, as a world view. I can't. Perhaps it's a question of language, but it has a world view. It has an ontological stance about the world. So that was kind of one point. It's an ideology I choose, but it's nevertheless in my language an ideology. The other point I wanted to make that I was kind of interested in is to me Buddhism is in the sense of a worldview, is intrinsically about interconnection. So that the notion of engagement for me has been there from the beginning. It may be something we choose to place more emphasis on, but it is intrinsically, ontologically, you know, in the weave of Buddhism. So, I'd be interested in your view about the ideological question.
Can you hear me now? Good, good. So I was referring to the question of this business of ideology. Now I'm using ideology in a specialist term of collective delusion. And what you're referring to in the first part of your first question is what I would call a clear seen theory, sort of William Blake theory, a clear theory. By theory, I mean some kind of guiding belief, or way of proceeding, which is not corrupted by delusion. And what Blake calls the windows of perception have been cleared. Okay. Now, Buddhism is ultimately that. Ultimately that. But where all of us start with Buddhism is with Buddhism as an ideology. Something which supports the self, right? In Zen, it's tended to be big E. You want to get big E. So with any other thing like that, you pay your money, join the group, get a teacher, and all the rest, and eventually you have big E. And heaven help you if you do, in one sense, because it can lead to what Jung calls spiritual inflation. So where we all start, it's... Chogram Trungpa called it spiritual materialism. We start off with these beliefs, and the whole practice is about slowly letting go of them, not achieving it, just letting go of them. So all those pictures which the needy self creates of Buddhism, as they see it, gradually fade away into an acceptance. Story from my own experience, which I've told an awful lot of people, is that I found I was a lousy meditator. All my friends were having profound insights, and we were all as a good old-fashioned Rinzai do, and everybody brought their Western notions of achievement and competitiveness. And I'd achieved well in other aspects of life, but here I was, deeply ashamed and deeply mortified. Friend comes back. Oh, how'd you get on retreat? Oh, how wonderful insight. Whoa, nothing. And one day I suddenly woke up, you know, you're just no good at this, Jones. You're just no good, you know. So it occurred to me, what's the problem? Except the fact you're just no good at it. Great, freedom. Easy as that. It's so easy. That's what makes teaching this stuff so saddening. See people struggling away, and yet suddenly, you know, what's it all about? You know, what's the problem? So we move through our own Buddhist practice from ideology. You know, making an ideology of Buddhism, bit by bit by bit, we move from it. And when the last bit drops away, we've crossed the river more or less, and we don't need the raft. That's it. See what I mean? So you're quite right to say Buddhism is an ideology. It's quite a dangerous one, as we've seen. See how it's operating in Sri Lanka with the Buddhist Sangha there. They've got an engagement, all right, but what a kind of engagement to ferocious Sinhalese nationalism. So, yeah, Buddhism is an ideology. Buddhism isn't an ideology. Otherwise, we'll carry on with it.
My own family's tradition has been involved in sort of that sort of labour struggle. I mean, my grandfather was born in Dublin at the turn of the century, and at the age of 15, he was embroiled in the War of Independence. And I suppose it's a good example of what happens when you've got the structural violence of empire coming up against the sort of, in some way you'd say, the righteous rage of the oppressed, and how that vortex of violence then, even if the liberation is successful, perpetuates ingrained violence as one of the methods that they've, of their victory, really. So I suppose what I'm exploring myself is to what extent your collectives of rebel contemplatives are able to successfully bring down the walls of Constantinople without getting embroiled in the violence of that process itself. And it was just, I found this lovely quote by a German anarchist called Gustav Landauer. I don't know if I've pronounced that right. And he says, "The empire or the state is not something which we can destroy by violent revolution, but it is a condition, a certain relationship between human beings, a mode of human behavior. We destroy it by contracting other relationships, by behaving differently." So it's I suppose, if what is the toolkit of the rebel contemplatives once that they've sorted out their own shit, really?
Well, I already indicated the main features of the toolkit, but your question, Richard, brings up quite an important point, that none of us are perfect. You get involved in this stuff, whether in the helping side or whether in the sort of radical social change side, and there are always some vestiges of what I call delusion, which is why in Zen we hold the Buddha is still practicing with us. You know, perfection is just that ideological and delusive notion. I'll give you an example. When I worked in the Samaritans, I eventually got the job of selecting people to be Samaritans. We don't do a lot of training in the Samaritans because we believe to some extent, unfortunately, they're born rather than trained. And there's one kind of person I always rejected. And that was the kind of person who didn't realize where all of their helping, some of their helping, motivation was coming from. They did perhaps genuinely want to help other people, but they didn't appreciate that they themselves were trying to help themselves in this. Because if you want to help someone else, that can mean that you think, well, that poor devil over there, you know, I can help them, which means you're a little bit superior to them. And it can mean, I'll find an answer for them. If someone rings you up at 3 o'clock at night and says, I'm going to top myself, what are you going to do about it? Which happened quite, not infrequently. The last thing you want to hear from you is how you're going to help them. All the bright ideas you've thought. Have you seen your GP? That's kind of nonsense. They've been through all that. They want you to be humble and selfless and simply hang out with them and listen to their story, then they may listen to yours. And sometimes I couldn't help the person killing themselves. But many times we ended up, just as dawn was breaking, laughing over some dark, comic joke. I don't know where it came from. None of us knew where it came from. So we make all sorts of mistakes, and we venture into these quite dangerous waters of both helping in social service and in activism. And we acknowledge our failings and our weaknesses. Just like I suddenly woke up by acknowledging I was a deaf meditator. That's how it is. The worst is if we try and wriggle away and say, oh, I'm not really like that, and all that kind of stuff. We are all, we carry our failings, and we all have our weaknesses and our failings. And the whole game we're into is not about somehow abandoning these and diluting them or getting rid of them. It's about the acceptance of them. And in that acceptance lies the beginning of the way to true liberation.